Okay, so we've been through some stuff, isn't that true? Okay, so what we're going to talk about is attitudinal responses to that fact. So when you're talking about your feelings about anything, that statement is predicated on this, that you have some idea of who you are. So I want to talk to you about the difficulty of going there, to that place of self-knowledge. If you're talking about knowing somebody else, the way we know people is usually through their communication with us. So, for instance, if I would just come here and say, I know Obama. You look at me and say, Tzipora, you know Obama? And they'll say, yeah, I saw a picture of him. That's Zeloza. That's not it. Suppose I said, well, no, I didn't just see his picture. Why, 30 years ago, I was a waitress, and I once actually saw him pass by in the cafeteria. That's not knowing him either. And if you say, well, did he talk to you? And I would say, yes. He said, sugar and milk. But also, okay, so knowing someone means that they communicate to you who they are, essentially. But I want to tell you something. Speech is not the person. It's just what they want you to know of who they are, essentially. It's not the whole person. So when you say, and who am I, and you listen to what you say, Maharal says that's the key. If you want to know who you are, listen to what you say, which of course leads to many unpleasant surprises, by the way. But that's only partial. It's not the whole story. I want you to go inside now. We think, and we think in both words and in images. We think in words and pictures. When you think in words or in pictures, you also don't know yourself. You know the message you're sending to yourself about what's happening. Your thoughts are your verbal messages, but this time it's not to another person. Who is it to? Yourself. So the question is, who are you talking to? Who's the self? It's not an easy question. So the answer to that question is the self is the deepest part of who we are, not just how we express that part, but what it is in essence. There are many traits that define that self. I'm going to only speak about two of them. Okay, so when you're thinking about your deep pleasure, one pleasure that we have as human beings that involves who we are is the pleasure of feeling contributive. Could you see where this is so? So I want to share with you something that was literally one of the most joyous experiences that I had in my life. I was going to my Monday night shiur with my friend Hanna Losher, some of you might know her, and we were walking down the street from Shar Yafo to the Rova. We passed the Kishla prison. Some of you who have been in the Rova know that like lovely landmark of the Turkish oppression, okay, which is still used as a lockup. And there was a woman sitting, do you know what I'm talking about? You didn't notice it because of the parking lot in front of it. It's right near Migdal David. This is an ancient lockup, okay? So if you ever get in trouble in the Rova, you may get to know it. Okay, so there was a woman sitting on the stone fence, a young woman, say from her appearance, late 20s, early 30s, who was weeping, but like her body was shaking. So I went over and I said, what happened? And she told me she's divorced. Her husband's not paying her the money he should be paying her. It's hard. She doesn't have a job. She looked to me to be emotionally fragile. I'm not sure she could hold down a job. She said that she promised her kids a nice supper, something special because they were good. And in order to be able to get it to them, she went down to Ben Yehuda, and she was begging, and she said, I got nothing. So, as Hashem's providence would happen, that night I had money in my pocketbook. I had 200 shekels. I gave her the whole thing because I realized if she doesn't have supper for them, there's a lot she doesn't have besides that. And my friend also gave her money. And I never saw somebody transform so quickly. She literally flew away towards her house. This was around 8:30, a quarter to 9. Her kids must have been waiting for supper for hours. She ran right into the makolet and she started buying things. So we were so happy. I want you to, you know, like, It worked. She's buying the things. The kid, yeah. We literally, my friend and I, there was nobody else in the street, we danced. So that's it was a joyous moment. You understand that? Okay. Everybody wants moments like that. Isn't that true? There's another kind of internal joy we have. That's the joy of overcoming an obstacle. When you thought you couldn't do it, and you thought it was too hard, you thought you would, in the end, fail, and you stood up to whatever it is that you stood up to. There's a lot of joy there. So that self is the deepest self, the knowing self, the self that is connective, the self that loves overcoming. And we're in touch with that self sometimes. Now you could wonder, why am I talking to you about this? This isn't Psychology 101 or Kabbalah 101. The reason why I'm talking to you about this is that Hashem on his side wants us to be able to find that place in ourselves, because that's the place of our deepest joy. So to take this a little bit deeper still, before we get into more concrete talk, when you ask, and that self, what's its deepest pleasure? So the Kabbalistic answer will be two words, Ratzon and Oneg. Ratzon means your will. Now most of the time our will is very outwardly directed. I want to get that parking space. Okay. I want to decide what I want more. Like there are five items on this Chinese menu that I haven't tasted yet. Do I want Muchu Ayang or do I want... Okay. Most of the time it's... But every so often we ask ourselves, and this is a good exercise for you to do if you want to know who you are, ask yourself what you really want. We have so much busy. You know what I mean by busy? Get up in the morning, like you have to hurry up and get out, like take a shower, get the clothes on because you have to get to work. You have to get to work because you have to earn some money. You have to earn some money and you have to get some personal satisfaction out of what you're doing. And it's all, what are you doing it for? Where are you running? Every so often ask yourself, where am I running? What do I really want to get? If I could have whatever I wanted, what would it be? The other deeper part of yourself that you might want to be in touch with is called Oneg, which means spiritual pleasure. So I want to introduce you to how this works. Think of the person in the world who you like the best. I'm not going to ask you who it is. Okay, you there? Yes? I realize this is New York, you know. The person who you dislike the least. Okay. Okay. You there? Okay. So I'm not going to ask you who the person is. I told you that. But I'm going to ask you something else. Why did you choose this person? What do you like about them? No? Yeah, you.
I like what they have to say.
Okay, you like what they have to say. You. Yeah.
I like their softness.
Their softness. Okay. Oh, somebody actually raised their hands. The courageous person. Yeah.
That's not threatening.
What? They're not threatening. They're safe.
They're involved in 24/7 present.
That's something to like in a person. Okay.
They're a genuinely good person.
Okay. What's good about them?
That they give.
They're giving. Okay. I'm not going to go through all of you, but I could, all right, what do you say? Thank you. Oh, sorry. But I want to guarantee you something. Nobody will ever give a physical answer to that question. I even asked this question to non-religious people in Las Vegas, which was very risky. He has great abs. Okay, whatever. Nobody said that. It came down, they said the same things that you say. Giving, kind, safe emotionally, soft, refined, loyal, humorous. These are all spiritual traits. So what we love in the other person is their spirituality. Could you see where this is so? So I'm going to ask you another question, which is, and if you feel when you're with them, the way you describe them as being, if you feel softer and kinder and more loyal, and you feel like you're a kind, good person, do you like them even better? Okay. That's called spiritual bonding. That's called spiritual bonding. And that's the greatest pleasure this world has. Now, we make a mistake in our goal to bond spiritually. What we're really seeking is the spiritual soul, which is something of God, as it filters through the other person and touches us and releases that as well. If you think the other person is God, which some of us do, we demand perfection from people who we love. That leads to extreme pain and embitterment. Could you see where this is so? So it's important to recognize that what you're searching is for God. It comes through the person, but it's not the person. Okay, so the question is, how do you find this? How do you find this? So the way we discover this godliness that we've just discussed is through the two things we just said, through giving, through the other person's giving, through our own giving, and through overcoming. This is how we discover it. So when you look at what's been happening to us, both to us in the greater sense in Eretz Yisrael, in the more specific sense, our friend Sandy, did you realize that the name Sandy will never be popular again? You know, like, until that was like such a neat name, there were so many girls named Sandy. No one's going to look at a new baby. Let's name her Sandy. That's not going to happen for quite a while, okay? So let's see what did it bring us towards? Okay, so I want to tell you what the goal is. There's a Mishnah that says, Kol Yisrael yesh lehem chelek l'olam haba. Every Jew has a portion in the world to come. Hashem gives us what we need to have to discover our holier self, our better self, the oneg and the ratzon, the chesed and the gvura, the spiritual capacity that leads to bonding that will give us access to our chelek in the world to come. So what does that mean? What it means is that these phenomena are meant to be factors that will give us the opportunity for self-discovery and for discovery of what we love in other people. So let's look at how this works. There are many people in this room certainly, who've had to receive from others. Is that true or not? So there are two responses you could make to that. One is, it's so painful. I like giving, I don't like receiving. Receiving makes me feel small, it makes me feel inadequate. It's painful. What's another response? The other response is, what a beautiful thing I discovered in that person. What beautiful people we're surrounded by. Have any of you stepped back enough to notice the great beauty of the people in the community? People who open their homes, people who give large sums of money to people who they'll never see with great discretion, people who were out there manning the food distribution depots, people who put up signs like, I have power, if you need to, charge your phone, take a shower, come to my house. Okay, got the picture? You've seen these? This could be your source of delight. It could touch your will that says, I want to be like that. It could be something beautiful. Now you have a role here, a role for yourself and a role that involves the other person. The role for yourself is to be aware, to be in touch with your higher self. What do I really want? Where am I going? What am I trying to discover? And the other role is to let the other person know what you've seen in them. Let people know what you've seen. Express yourself to them so they could discover their own hidden beauty. And there's more. There's not only what people have done for you. There's what people have done for themselves. What they've discovered in themselves, their fortitude, their ability to move on. What does Hashem want us to gain through all of this? So as I just said before, you're chelek in olam haba. In Chovot HaLevavot, the author talks to us about what that means. He says that there are four factors that affect your chelek in Olam Haba. What are they? The first one is your deeds. First factor is what? Everything you do transforms you and changes the world. Now you could divide deeds into three categories. I'm going to tell you what the categories are and then go over them slowly. Positive deeds that bond you to Hashem and to the other person, which come through the positive mitzvot. The second is deeds that give you the ability to overcome everything that's negative, everything that's limiting. This comes through the negative mitzvot. The third is the ability to awaken what's holy and what the hidden potentials are in ordinary experiences. That's called who you are in the world of Divrei Rishut, things over which you have your own authority. So I want to go over these three parts of deed before we go further. Let's look at positive mitzvot. A positive mitzvah means you're going to take some capacity that you have within you, look for a situation in which you could give it expression, and do it. And at that moment, something happens. What happens is spiritual bonding. The first one to discover this was Avraham. So what he did was to look for experiences of those great, to re-experience the moment I shared with you a moment ago, every day, again and again. How could I bond? Where's the goodness? Who needs? How could I give? Now, there are two ways a person could give. Are you familiar with people who nebuch give? You know what I mean? Well, I overcame and I contributed. That's not what I'm talking about. There are 248 easily observed limbs and organs of the body, meaning if you were to kill somebody tonight when you go home, just to see if what I'm telling you is true, and you would open them up and you would say, like, well, there's this and there's that and there, you know, whatever, you would get 248. Every physical part of the body has a spiritual counterpart. The great Kabbalists could tell you what organ parallels which form of expression. But suffice to say, your liver purifies or acts to require you say yes to this, no to that. Okay. And that's the same thing for every limb and organ. Avram wanted to find every potential and give it expression. This is hinted at by the fact that there were 248 positive mitzvot, which is the gematria of the name Avraham. That's Avraham. Avram's alive and well in the heart of everybody in this room. It's a promise Hashem made to me. It's the basis of your Olam Haba, your ability to transcend the limitations of physicality. The second path is overcoming. Now, again, I don't mean, well, I know. Okay. There are two kinds of justice. One is the justice you see in a secular court. Let's say you were speeding, and you really were speeding, and the policeman apprehends you, and he gives you a ticket. And you go to court, you plead not guilty, because you're Jewish, you figure it always pays to pay, okay, whatever. Okay. Either you'll get off, or you won't get off. Okay, but in any case, and you're found guilty and you pay the fine, right? Now suppose you were to think to yourself, like 20 years later, I've been clean for 20 years. I haven't gotten any traffic violations since that original one. So you make an appointment to go to court, and you go before the judge, and you say, I deserve something. Magiali, 20 years I haven't gotten a ticket. What's my reward? Now, in secular courts, there's only punishments and no rewards. You can't go and say, haven't killed anyone. It's not going to get you anything. Okay, Hashem's justice is really his way of creating balance. So when we talk about Midas Adin, we're talking about giving just as much as taking. Giving reward, punishment, meaning keeping us in line. Keeping us in line with what? With him. Yitzchak began where Avraham ended. His greatest desire was to be alleged and aligned with Hashem. He didn't want anything to get in the way. He wanted a devoted relationship. What does a devoted relationship mean? It means that you feel utterly dependent on Hashem, and you respond in that way. So this is called, on a deep level, having fear of Hashem. When most people use the word fear of Hashem, you know what they mean? Fear of suffering. That's not fear of Hashem, that's fear of suffering. That's why I just called it fear of. Hashem's barely in the picture. Now, the truth is that if you don't sin because you're afraid of the consequences, that's a very good thing. First of all, because there are consequences. And also it keeps you in the straight and narrow. Don't mistake that. That's not fear of Hashem. Fear of Hashem is when Hashem is so vivid to you, so awesomely real, that, and you recognize your life is hanging on by a thread. You can't not do His will. It's a devoted relationship. I want you to understand this better. We said that Avram wanted to use everything he could in service of Hashem. So he would pray. The prayer that he initiated was Shacharit, which is the morning prayer. He would see the day unfolding, moving from blackness to dawn. This is, by the way, the root of the word Shacharit is Shachor, moving from blackness to day. And you say, I have to make a response. How can I make a response? Oh, okay, whatever. Yitzchak didn't do that prayer. He said Shacharit, but he initiated a whole other kind of prayer. The prayer that he initiated was called Mincha. Mincha doesn't mean afternoon. You'll look in your Siddur, it'll say on the Hebrew side, Mincha, and in the English side, it'll say afternoon prayers. No. What does the word Mincha mean? Gift. Giving what? Giving your ego, giving your sense of control, recognizing that nothing you could do will get you what you want in the deepest sense, giving yourself to Hashem. Which is why people find davening Mincha so difficult. The afternoon's short, and you're so busy, like doing things that are absolutely essential, like essential. You know, like you have to do, okay, your whole afternoon is full of essential activities. So stopping makes you realize what? You're hanging by a thread. So I want you to go back to the storm, and then I want to take you back to Israel. So I don't know how it was for you to be here. I can't put myself in your body. I'm just going to share with you what somebody wrote up about how his own responses to the storm were. It was a man, he was in Area B. He thought it would be okay, didn't evacuate, didn't take real precautions. And then it happened. And he ends up having to run to his neighbor's house, which was higher up, wrapping up the kids in a blanket, running with them, his wife coming after him with the other kids. Discovery number one. What's discovery number one? I'm alive. Thank God. When was the last time you thought that? Okay. The first step in relinquishing control is recognizing your life doesn't belong to you. Thank God you're alive. God, your kids are alive. Your husband are alive. It's a gift. Step two. My neighbor opened the door. My neighbor opened the door. That gives you, again, we spoke about spiritual bonding, a vision of the other person's goodness. Step three, I control nothing. You all stood there. These are holy moments. These are moments that should say, my life hangs by a thread. Of course I'll do His will. I would never dream of transgressing. Who am I to? The same thing was happening a short time later in Israel. I don't know if any of you kept tally of it, but 2 days before the ceasefire, when they publicized how many missiles were actually sent over, 1,537 2 days before the ceasefire. Everybody's life was hanging by a thread. Now, I was in a taxi, and the driver, I was going from Jerusalem to Rehovot, so I thought I had a nice, quiet hour. You know, you could go wherever you want in your mind. A little silence is good. But this is Israel. I'm not alone. Who am I with? the driver. It's just like now me and Dudu on this, like, you know, on this date that I never agreed to go on. Okay, you know what I mean? Like you've been like this. So after like turning on the news very loud and reviewing with me its contents, he asked me if I knew how the Iron Dome defense system worked. Now, I was very tempted to say, of course. But, you know, my honesty got... The truth is, I have no idea. I had, at that time, no idea whatsoever of how it worked. So he felt it necessary to tell me because he has a friend who's in the army who knows from this. I saw a picture of it. Did any of you see pictures of it? So it looks like a big... for those of you who didn't, it looks like this big truck that's sort of on its side. It looks like it'd be the kind of truck that delivers big bottles of soda, but instead of soda bottles, there are missiles, okay? And elsewhere, far away, there's a computer. And the program is so sensitive that it could apprehend missiles that have been sent over, send the missiles in the defense system to explode them midair. They could tell where the missiles are programmed to land. So 87.6% of the time, it worked. Okay, so he's explaining all of this to me, and he explained to me about the program also, which I understood nothing of, but I was just, oh, Ken Bennett, or whatever. And, you know, and when he more or less finishes, He realized he has me in his hand. I'm like nodding. He said, "Aval giveret hakol hashkacha eliona." He got it. Everybody got it. Nobody thought this was normal. How could you think this is normal? What was normal about it? There were news clips of people who walked out of buildings that were reduced to rubble. There was a picture that some of you may have seen of a building in Ashdod where the eighth floor took a direct hit. The whole building is sort of like the Leaning Tower of Pisa, and nobody was hurt. Okay, we're on a string, so we should feel ourselves in response to God who loves us, who cares about us, and say, I don't want to do anything that will damage me, and nothing will damage me the way sin does. You have to trust him that when he set forth the rules, he knows what the rules are for. They're not for him, they're for us, for our benefit. But in order to gain what the rules are meant to give us, we have to relinquish control. So I want to talk to you about how that works with mitzvot. There are mitzvot that we like and mitzvot that we don't. So I want to tell you something very interesting about negative mitzvot. They're only relevant if you don't want to keep them. So I want to explain this to you. One of the mitzvot in the Torah is don't make tattoos. Okay, I got up in the morning today, but I think, maybe a tattoo. No, I didn't think that. I have to tell you, I did not think that. So I know this is a shocker to you. A little rose with, you know, Okay, so I'm not going to, I didn't observe the mitzvah of not making a tattoo. It wasn't on the screen. There are a lot of other negative mitzvahs that I didn't keep because they weren't on the screen. It says in the Torah, don't give your child to the Molech. Okay, which was the god that they worshipped in ancient times. The ritual was they had the idol carved empty, made out of metal, with coals on the inside. It was huge, so it was considered an act of great religious devotion to pass one's child through this so they would burn to death. I didn't think about that today. I mean, even when my kids were younger, even when they did things like, you know, like, I could honestly say, like, even when, like, somebody was baking and they left half the batter in my slipper, I didn't actually think, maybe the Molech. Okay. A negative mitzvah is relevant when you don't want to keep it. When you're afraid of somebody else's response, but you tell the truth anyway. When you're in pain about something that took place and you decide not to speak Lashon Hara. So that sort of response is one of bitul hayesh, negation of ego, relinquishment of control. That's Yitzchak's midah. But then there's what I really want to talk about, the great world of things over which you have your own authority. There's no halacha. There are many decisions in life over which there's no halacha. Should I marry him or should I wait until somebody decent comes along? I mean, should I, you know, what's for dinner? Is any law requiring you to make this or that? How many bedtime stories do you have to tell before your yotze? Okay, there's no halacha there. So you could think, because there's no halacha, that there's no way of taking this, which is the majority of our life decisions, and sanctifying them. But what living a life that connects you is about is using your moment-to-moment choices in the areas of life over which you can make any decision and say, I want to make the decision that draws me closer to the oneg, to the ratzon, to the chesed, to the gvur, to the essential self, because this is what Hashem wants of me. So this ability is something that we've inherited from Yaakov, and this is why the prayer that he initiated in Ma'ariv, what's the literal meaning of Ma'ariv? Not night, that's Laila. Mixed. Larvev is to mix. Okay, mixed experiences. Okay, Hashem seems to not be here, but he really is. That's Ma'ariv time. Okay, that's the area of Divrei Rishut, which is why in Halacha, Ma'ariv is an optional prayer. It's not required. Men have taken it on as a minhag. So it has the force of halacha in many ways, but it's an optional prayer. So now we know the first way to get your olam haba. Let's go through this. Your deeds will get you there or not get you there. And that includes mitzvot aseh, mitzvot lo taseh, and divrei rishus. And now, if you think about it and step back, you could see that this is where your experiences should be taking you, to rededication to those directions. Second thing, it's not only your deeds. The second thing, there are going to be four. The second thing is emuna. What's emuna? Emuna means faith. Faith doesn't mean wishful thinking. People are very mistaken in that regard. People say, oh, I have emuna. That means I for sure will get whatever I want whenever I want it. Right, Tinkerbell? Okay, emuna means recognizing everything is from God and therefore ultimately compassionate. It either feels good or doesn't feel good. If it feels good, it should inspire you. If it doesn't, you should recognize that rectification will come thereby. That's emuna. How does emuna look? How does it look when it's real? So the way emuna looks when it's real is when you don't have to have the happy ending in sight. When you don't know what the ending will be, but you're sure it'll be good. So you could have two people doing the same deed, one with emuna, one without, and the qualitative difference is huge. Next thing. In addition to emuna, in addition to doing the right thing, the next thing is, how do you affect others? How do you affect others? So let's go back to what was going on during this horrific storm. There was a lot of interaction. Treasure it. Let it make you commit to giving what you received next time around. Okay, there are people who you helped materially, people who helped you materially. There are people who you cared about, and people who cared about you. Is that true? So I want to tell you something that's really tragic. If you're not careful, you're going to forget it. How long do you think it'll take you to forget it? No time. So let it affect how you are towards others in the future. Be sensitive, be caring. Let the way you are touch other people. How so? So some of you here are Balei Tshuva. Some of you are not. And then you could ask, why am I not doing Tshuva? Okay, whatever, but that's a different question. So I want to tell you something that I've noticed over the years. There are different ways that people come to change their lives. And the stories that people tell about how they came to change their lives are fascinating. Is that true or not? But there's always going to be one component that you find in every single story. And you know what that is? I met somebody who touched me. There was somebody who did something that I saw as beautiful. Could be a Shabbat that you go to. Could be somebody who opened a book and told you something you didn't know before. Could be somebody you saw doing a chesed. I have yet to meet somebody who changed their life without being touched by somebody's example. Provide example. It'll change your olam haba. And we were given opportunity to do this. Last thing. The last thing, and this is the one that's hardest to take but most relevant to you. The last component of what makes your olam haba is suffering. Suffering. Why should suffering help you gain olam haba? So I want to tell you why. There's all sorts of suffering. But what all of the different kinds of suffering have in common is that when a person is suffering, they know that they have no control. This could be emotional suffering, this could be physical suffering, this could be financial suffering. So you have four components of what brings you to your olam haba: your deeds, your faith, your effect on others, and how much you suffered. How much you suffered. In the Talmud it says that when we're judged by God, we're going to have complaints about his judgment. So I want to tell you what the complaint won't be. It won't be that we're judged too severely. I want to tell you we're very hard on ourselves. Have you noticed this? God's far more compassionate than we are. He doesn't forget anything, but he judges us with compassion. You know what the complaint will be? Why did you give me such an easy life? I could have been something. I could have run the fast track. I could have been something. Because suffering generates that, potentially. So everybody who experienced the storm had at least some moments in which they were fully aware that they have no control. Is that so? I heard Mordechai ben David talk about what happened to his home. Some of you may have heard this as well. He had no idea of how fast the rains would fill his basement, which is also a studio. Now, here he is, like, arguably, certainly the best known of all of the Jewish singers today. And he's watching his studio and all of his computers and all of his music slowly submerge into the water. You know what Avram Fried said about him? He said, Mordechai ben David has a voice you have once in a generation, but why did it have to be my generation? Okay, so in any case. And it's getting higher and higher, and he was at the top of the stairwell, like mesmerized by what he's seeing, and suddenly it stopped. It stopped right below a picture he had hung on the wall. This picture wasn't a picture of him singing or any of his awards. This was a picture that he had made after the Ribnitzer Rebbe was Nifter. He had served as his gabbai for many years. When he was Nifter, he hung his picture on the wall. The water stopped right before it reached the picture. And you know what he said to himself? That's the only part of my reality that's real. Everything else isn't so real. And this is how it is for all of us. The storm should have the effect of letting you come back to question, what about me is real? What's enduring? What's going to be with me in Olam Haba? What am I going to take? So we had the opportunity to go there, and it should be something we treasure. So taking this one step further, how are we going to retain it? How are we going to retain what we learned? So, you know, even in Israel, I want to share with you something that I once saw. There was, during Baba Sali's lifetime, there was, one of the secular newspapers, Mariv, had an interest in showing that he's just like, you know, charlatan. So one of their reporters was sent to Netivot to prove that all of his supposedly great powers are really nothing, and it's just like at most the placebo effect. So they decided to do a thorough job and document it. So the reporter found a man who was traveling to Netivot to ask for healing. The man was blind. So he asked him, I'll pay you for your time. Do you have documentation about your vision? He said, documentation? I have a tick this thick in Hadassah. He had, if I'm not mistaken, molecular degeneration. And he had many, many pages of examinations and attempted medications and this and that. The guy's blind. Okay. The reporter went with him to Netivot. Baba Sali saw him, said a bracha on water, drank some, and put some on his eyes, and he was able to see. Okay, how do you think the reporter responded? Remember what he was hired to do, and remember what he's seeing in front of his eyes. Well, how do you think he responded? He wrote up the story. This is how I know the story. He wrote it up exactly as it was. He had copies of the medical records. He had his own testimony to what he saw there. And the headline was, Nes Gadol Benetivot. Do you think he necessarily changed his life in any way? So I don't know. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. I have no idea. I'm going to assume he didn't, because it's human nature not to. Take these moments that are your Me'ein Olam Haba and let them change you. So that means that tonight when you come home from the Shir, go back to your moments of vulnerability, your moments of emunah, your moments of resolution, and say, how am I going to concretize this in the real world? And write it down. What's the enemy? What do you think will make you not remember any of this? It's not going to be skepticism. You know what it's going to be? The busy. The good old busy. I'm going to share with you a story that I might have told you before. In fact, I'm sure I told you before, but you'll survive. At one point, we were living in the north on this tiny little moshav called Segev. And this was during the Yom Kippur War. We were so distant from anything that we weren't attached to the defense system, so we didn't know there was a war. So the army came to get the men, and they didn't want to go. They're religious, it's Yom Kippur, but whatever. Make a long story short, several days into the war, we want to know what's really happening because you can't rely on the news too much. Our neighboring Jewish moshav, which was not so near, was called Yodfat. This is a place that, in terms of like the Israeli political spectrum, they're so far left that if the world was flat, they would have fallen off the edge. They once did a spiritual evening and they invited monks from an Arab abbey to speak. This is like how far left. So the men were coming home, and we all wanted to see what's really happening. So I want you to picture, this is like Israel, maybe somewhere between 60 and 80 people are jammed into somebody's Israeli living room. The soldiers came in, it was a small group, and I still remember my feelings. We addressed the oldest guy. The oldest guy must have been 30, which to me, everybody was young then in the Hityashviot. That seemed very old to me. It's like 30. You know, like you could like trust what he says. He's not a kid. He's, you know, like 30. Okay, so we all like pounce on him and say, what's happening? And he said, Ra'ino Nisim, we saw miracles. You all know what cognitive dissonance is? I was in cognitive dissonance. I like the words, but it's coming out of the wrong mouth. He said, Nisim? And that was more or less everybody's response. Everybody says, Ma, Nisim? Eze Nisim. See, the first day of the war, the Arabs could easily have taken Tzfat. They encamped near Tzfat as though they were waiting for us to come. And then when we came, they ran away. Would you run away from us? I'm thinking, no. I realized that wasn't the tactful thing to say, that it was a rhetorical question. And nobody he was with, other soldiers, they were all agreeing with him. There was the nod, you know, yeah, yeah. Do you think everybody in the room believed what he said? Absolutely. Did anyone change, really? Two people did. It's two people out of maybe 60, 70. Okay, I saw the moment when I knew no one's going to really change, or at least that's what I thought. The woman whose house it is, very appropriately, there was nothing wrong with what she did, turned to the soldiers and said, "Do you want coffee?" I mean, they just came in from fighting. And that led to with sugar, without sugar, with milk. What do you mean you don't have milk? They're not delivering milk. We could fight a war. They can't deliver milk. I will never vote for Avodah again. Okay, you know, and it was all over. It's the busy, busy. You may be there already. Don't let it divorce you from your higher self, from the ratzon, from the oneg, from the chesed, from the gvura. Concretize it. Get up in the morning and ask yourself who you really are and what you really want. And treasure the moments of difficulty, the moments of fear, and let them affect the rest of your life. Do people ever do this? They do. So I'm going to tell you about one of the men in the room who changed. So he was later called up. He had then a very unglamorous job. Tanks have 12 people who work it, at least the kind of tanks they had then. I don't know what they have now. And each one of them has a different job. His job, which is the least glamorous job there is, he's called the tank ima, the tank mommy. What does that mean? Somebody has to make sandwiches, and somebody has to clean out the chemical toilet, and somebody has to, you know, like, that's his job. I mean, it sounds much better if people say, "What are you?" You say, "Ani tankist," without getting into too much detail. So one of his jobs was to, in order that, like, the tank commander not hear instructions that aren't relevant, to filter the instructions and to press a button that will transmit anything that's really meant for the commander to the commander, okay? So he had a little portal, and he could see the battle taking place outside through this portal. He sees that the Syrians are coming towards them. He gets an instruction that he's supposed to transmit, saying, "Move south away from the Syrians." But he could see the Syrians are coming from the south. Moving south will put the tank in the way of the Syrians. He had a split second to make a decision. If you were him, would you transmit the message or not?
No.
He didn't. Now, the one thing they drum through every soldier's head is you don't play around with commands. Not transmitting a message from the high command to a tank commander when you're a little nobody is, it's not so simple. But he looked at the portal and he realized, I'm not going to do this. So he didn't transmit the message. And nobody found out about it. But he realized something. You know what he realized? The people in the high command who he had idealized, they're the same people who run Eged. They're the same people who run the trade unions. They're just people. And that our survival is coming from a higher source. And that readied him to hear what he had heard before about Nisim, and that led him to doing complete tshuva. Shortly thereafter, we were living, as I said, in a moshav that wasn't so far from Yodfat. It was like these things in the children's tzaddikim book. We're sitting and eating breakfast, my husband and I. There's a knock on the door. And there he is. He says, "Shamati shepo lomdim Torah, efshar lilmod." I felt like, sure, Akiva, no problem. Okay, you know, but, you know, so people do let things touch them. But you have to have some inner commitment, and that begins with being in touch with what you really want. So I'm going to conclude with this. What you really want is the intimacy and the joy of achievement that could be your portion in Olam Haba. You want the mitzvot, the aseh and the lo taseh and the reshus. You want the emunah. You want the moments of elation. You want to see yourself affecting others, and you want to learn something from the suffering. And it's not as hard as you think, as the Torah tells us. Ki karov elecha davar admod. It's very easy. So I'm concluding with this, and if you have questions, the time is now.
mindset of Hashem loves me, when you're going through actual, really difficult tests, some
yes.
people lost all their possessions.
Yes.
People lost
That's
their
right.
homes. Like, how do you maintain that Hashem loves me? Imagine, like, God forbid, next year we have another hurricane. Like, what kind of reaction would these people have? You know, like, people would be terrified. It wouldn't be like you trust God, you know, like, or would they?
So here's how it works. It says in the Torah, when praising Eretz Yisrael, it says Eretz Yisrael is this and that and the other, and this, and it's not like Eretz Mitzrayim. So Rashi asks, what's the Torah telling us? He points out that in Egypt, the people can count on their parnassah every year, because every year the Nile overflows its banks and then retracts, so people know for sure there's going to be enough water. Exactly when they know what to plant, what grows, how much they'll get, they have security. So the Torah says, Israel isn't that. Israel isn't security. Israel is when you're in Hashem's hand and you have to trust Him second by second for your life. So similarly, when a person loses their possessions, I'm not belittling this, I want to make that clear. Believe me, I love my possessions as much as the next person. But when a person loses their possessions, there are two things they see. One is these possessions were a gift, and I have them as long as I'm supposed to have them and not a second longer. And the other is the one who gave me these possessions can give me new possessions and better possessions. And I want to share with you something I actually saw with my own eyes. When my children were young, I needed a babysitter, so I found this woman. Her name was Hana Al-Krabli, a Moroccan woman. She had no children of her own, and she was very happy to be our babysitter. She sort of adopted us, and it was very interesting. She came from an island off Morocco, actually, very far removed from, like, 20th century life. The school that she went to offered the children, the girls, they could choose two professions. They could either be seamstresses or ladies' maids. So she learned to be a ladies' maid. So I would come home and I would find my kids, like, powdered and primped and this and that. The house a total wreck, but whatever. You know, so this is me and Hana. One day I came home and she's not there. Somebody else is there. So I said, where's Hana? She just, like, left you with the kids and went? I said, no. We got this call just like maybe a quarter of an hour ago. She had this terrible thing happen to her house. It was the freakiest thing. I have never heard anything as strange as this. Someone rang the bell. It shorted. That caused an electrical fire in the wiring of her whole house. Okay, the walls melted. Her husband was a sofa. You could imagine what happened from that. So I asked the woman, please stay a little longer. I want to go to Hana. So I went to her. She had only gotten there a short time before me. She was sitting on the steps in the stairwell by her house, and a neighbor was coming out of the door and handing her a box of tissues. And she sat up straight. She had a lot of this sort of Spanish nobility. She said, "Ani evkel dvarim gashmiim? Am I going to cry about material things?" And she said, "Hashem gave me this house, He could give me a better house." And you know what I was thinking? This wasn't my best moment, it was her best moment. I'm thinking, that's what you're saying now, but it's cute. That's because it didn't sink in yet. You're going to have to deal with this, but I'm keeping my mouth closed. But this is what I'm thinking. And her uncle in Venezuela died and left her a lot of money, and she bought a better house. So this is, you know, this is where it takes people. Okay. Yeah.
Really think what you want.
Yeah.
So how did you end with that, like, deep fried greasy Chinese
food? So,
like,
let's...
Like, your deepest feeling is, like, right now I do not want to get out of that. Or, like, sometimes you're...
Yeah,
like,
we could be honest,
yeah,
you know? Like,
your deepest thought is, I want to take my kids to the devil that you're talking about, that, you know, Mona, or whatever.
But you're not going to, you know. So let's go back to the Chinese food. Now it's mutter. We're talking about kosher food, right? Okay. So you could choose about who you'll be when you eat it. I'm not even talking about should you eat it, shouldn't you eat it. It's kosher, you could eat it. But when you say a bracha, you're going to be home or you're going to be away. You're going to be really noticing that this didn't come out of the air or out of the box magically. But it's a consequence of a God who cares enough about humans to make food that smells good, tastes good, looks good. You can have a little simcha in the bracha. If you say a bracha with simcha, I'm not even saying with kavana, just with simcha. Once or twice a day, it could be totally transformational.
So even if you're doing something that might not be so good for you, really the salad or
if it's mutter, again, I'm talking about what's mutter. I'm not talking about a diabetic eating ice cream or something like that. If it's mutter, you could elevate it. So this way of interaction with the world of Rishus is called birur. So I'll give you a heavy, deep explanation, which you were not asking for, I realize, but you know, that's life. Okay, on the highest level of all reality, everything is one. We say it every day, Hashem Echad. But to make himself approachable to us, he created different middos, through which we could sort of learn him. So one of them is his giving, and the other is his mishpat. So this is all coming from a unified place, but we experience Hashem in different ways. This is why it'll say in Az Yashir, Hashem Ish Milchama, Hashem, which is the name of Rachamim, is Ish Milchama, he's a man of war. Yes, he was destroying our enemies. You take this down one more level, okay? So Chesed and Gvur turn into what we'll call good and bad. Bad is really just stuff that challenges us, and good is really just stuff that inspires us. On the highest of all levels, it's one. So for anything to exist materially, like Chinese food, for instance, it comes from the same source as the most exalted of all possible experiences. It's up to you to find the spark of holiness there and to relate to it.
Okay.
Yes, okay. And as every year, okay, I'm from the vase, it's a tzedakah for the kalas. We make them from, you have to pay for it. So where's Linda? Is Linda here? Oy vey. She has the envelope. Maybe ask her for the envelope so we could pass it around. Okay. And give generously and remember that Hachnasas Kala, by its definition, it says anybody who marries off a couple, it's as though they rebuilt a home in Israel. So all of you who are in the process of rebuilding should remember what this mitzvah takes you to. Tell Zehu we'll find the envelope. Don't leave, I'll stand in front of the door. I'm sorry. Okay. Just get the envelope.